The pieces in the last room of the exhibit reflected Dial's spirituality and how he overcame serious illness. Everything about the artwork was vibrant, almost ecstatic, in a much different way from the rest of the exhibit. Dial's The Beginning of Life in the Yellow Jungle is an explosion of yellow, an artistic musing on life and how it evolves. The assemblage has fake plants, flowers made from plastic soda bottles, a doll serenely composed, and because of how these elements are held together with splash zone epoxy, you get the sense that everything is connected, both literally and figuratively. It was inspiring and refreshing to see an artist willing to explore happiness as much as he was willing to explore pain, anger, darkness, unhappiness. Dial's art argues that both light and dark can rise from an artist's experiences. I have been thinking about happy endings in life, in art, in literature. Dawn Tripp's Game of Secrets is, as you might imagine, a novel about secrets. Secrets among the novel's characters and secrets the author withholds from the reader. Most of the plot hinges on Tripp doling out pieces of these secrets a little at a time. The story begins with an affair and a decades-old murder. Sex, betrayal, death. The stuff of many interesting stories. There's some mystery to Game of Secrets, but mostly a man is dead and we know it, even if we don't know how he came to such a pass. The dead man was a father and an estranged husband and a lover. Game of Secrets is about many things, but mostly it revolves around the aftermath of this man, Luce Weld's death, and how, for decades, it affects many residents in a small New England town. We think we know who did it. Silas Varick, the husband of Ada Varick, with whom Luce Weld was having an affair. But we can't be sure. The story is told from multiple perspectives across several decades. But the two main characters are Marnie Dyer and her mother, Jane Dyer, who is the daughter of Luce Weld. Throughout the novel, Marnie is engaged in the fragile beginnings of a relationship with Ray Varick, Ada's son, and Jane is playing a game of Scrabble with Ada. In small towns, you can't really escape secrets or Scrabble. And what makes Game of Secrets so readable is that as a reader, you start to see that everyone knows a little something. Tripp makes it easy to piece together what everyone knows in order to see the whole story. The premise makes a happy ending seem nearly impossible because there are so many secrets that have been held close for so long. In such an atmosphere, there's bound to be unhappiness, sorrow, darkness, but these emotions don't overwhelm the story. Instead, the awkwardness of these secrets creates a mournful tone. As I neared the end, I wondered how the story could have a happy ending for anyone involved. Because I was invested, I wanted that happy ending for everyone. I wanted the people in this town to find their way out of the darkness, to reach a place of redemption, salvation, triumph, hope, happiness, a happy ending after a long, sorrowful journey, even if I couldn't see how that could be possible. And yet, there are happy endings in Game of Secrets for almost everyone involved. Even though those happy endings may not look the way we expect happy endings to look, just before his death, a man recognizes his son. A daughter finally begins to understand the mother who has long confounded her, and that daughter is able to grow, able to show her mother kindness. A husband tells his daughter his wife was the only one, has always been the only one, without regret. A woman makes peace with moving back to her hometown and tries to allow herself to love. A man remains open to love even when he is pushed away. The happy endings in Game of Secrets are subtle and incomplete, but they are there. And it works because happiness itself is often subtle and incomplete. Sometimes, and especially as a writer, I feel like I have no idea what happiness is, what it looks like, what it feels like, how to show it on the page. I have no problem with darkness, sorrow, pain, or unhappiness. I have no intention of straying from these themes in my writing. But, in considering the Dial exhibit and Game of Secrets, I wonder how we can complicate these themes that pervade fiction and art so we can also achieve a more complete, complex understanding of happiness. Happiness is not uninspiring if we don't allow our imaginations to fail us. I want to believe there is substance to fairy tales. I want to believe there's something to hold on to, even when dealing with the slick smoothness of idyll, of joy. The careless language of sexual violence. There are crimes, and then there are crimes, and then there are atrocities. These are matters of scale. I was shaken by an article in the New York Times about an 11-year-old girl who was gang-raped by 18 men in Cleveland, Texas. The levels of horror to this story are many, from the victim's age, to what is known about what happened to her, to the number of attackers, to the public response in that town, to how the story was reported. There is video of the attack, too, because this is the future. The unspeakable will be televised. The article was entitled, "Vicious Assault Shakes Texas Town," as if the victim in question were the town itself. James McKinley Jr., the article's author, focused on how the men's lives would be changed forever, how the town was being ripped apart, how those poor boys might never be able to return to school. There was discussion of how the 11-year-old girl, the child, dressed like a 20-year-old, implying that there is a realm of possibility where a woman can ask for it, and that it's somehow understandable that 18 men would rape a child. There were even questions about the whereabouts of the girl's mother, given, as we all know, that a mother must be with her child at all times, or whatever ill befalls the child is clearly the mother's fault. Strangely, there were no questions about the whereabouts of the father while this rape was taking place. The overall tone of the article was what a shame it all was. How so many lives were affected by this one terrible event. Little word space was spent on the girl, the child. It was an 11-year-old girl whose body was ripped apart, not a town. It was an 11-year-old girl's life that was ripped apart, not the lives of the men who raped her. It is difficult to make sense of how anyone could lose sight of that fact, and yet it isn't. We live in a culture that is overly permissive where rape is concerned. While there are certainly many people who understand rape and the damage of rape, we also live in a time that necessitates the phrase rape culture. This phrase denotes a culture where we are inundated in different ways by the idea that male aggression and violence toward women is acceptable and often inevitable. As Lynn Higgins and Brenda Silver ask in their book, Rape and Representation, how is it that in spite, or perhaps because of their erasure, rape and sexual violence have been so ingrained and so rationalized through their representations as to appear natural and inevitable to women as to men? This is an important question, trying to understand how we have come to this. We have also perhaps become immune to the horror of rape because we see it so often and discuss it so often, many times without acknowledging or considering the gravity of rape and its effects. We jokingly say things like, "I just took a rape shower," or, "My boss just totally raped me over my request for a raise." We have appropriated the language of rape for all manner of violations, great and small. It is not a stretch to imagine why James McKinley Jr., in his reportage, was more concerned about 18 men than one girl. The casual way in which we deal with rape may begin and end with television and movies, where we are inundated with images of sexual and domestic violence. Can you think of a dramatic television series that has not incorporated some kind of rape storyline? There was a time when these storylines had a certain educational element to them, a la A Very Special Episode. I remember, for example, the episode of Beverly Hills 90210, where Kelly Taylor discusses being date raped at a slumber party, surrounded tearfully by her closest friends. For many young women, that episode created a space where they could have a conversation about rape as something that was not just perpetrated by strangers. Later in the series, when the show was on its last legs, Kelly would be raped again, this time by a stranger. We watched the familiar trajectory of violation, trauma, disillusion, and finally vindication, seemingly forgetting we had sort of seen this story before. Nearly every other movie aired on Lifetime or Lifetime Movie Network features some kind of violence against women. The violence is graphic and gratuitous while still being strangely antiseptic, where more is implied about the actual act than shown. We consume these representations of violence and do so eagerly. There is a comfort, I suppose, to consuming violence contained in 90-minute segments, muted by commercials for household goods and communicated to us by former television stars with feathered bangs. While rape as entertainment fodder may have also once included an element of the didactic, such is no longer the case. Rape is good for ratings. In season 4 of ABC's Private Practice, Charlotte King, an iron-willed, independent, and sexually adventurous doctor, is brutally raped. This happened, of course, just as February sweeps were beginning. The depiction of the assault was as graphic as you might expect from primetime network television. For several episodes, we saw the attack and its aftermath. The narrative arc of how the once vibrant Charlotte became a shell of herself. How she became sexually frigid. How her body bore witness to the physical damage of rape. Another character on the show, Violet, bravely confesses she too had been raped. The show was widely applauded for its sensitive treatment of a difficult subject. The episode that began the arc, "Did You Hear What Happened to Charlotte King?" was the highest-rated episode of the season. General Hospital, like most soap operas, incorporates a rape storyline every 5 years or so when it needs an uptick in viewers. Emily Quatermain was raped, and before Emily, Elizabeth Weber was raped, and long before Elizabeth, Laura, of the infamous Luke and Laura, was raped by Luke. But that rape was okay, because Laura married Luke, so her rape doesn't really count. Every woman, General Hospital wanted us to believe, loves her rapist. In 2010, the rape storyline on the soap offered a twist. The victim was a man. Michael Corinthos III, son of Port Charles mob boss Sonny Corinthos, himself no stranger to violence against women. While it was commendable to see the show's producers trying to address the issue of male rape and prison rape, the subject matter was still handled carelessly, was still a source of titillation, and was still packaged neatly between commercials for cleaning products and baby diapers. Of course, if we are going to talk about rape and how we are inundated by representations of rape, and how perhaps we've become numb to rape, we have to discuss Law and Order SVU, which deals primarily in all manner of sexual assault against women, children, and, once in a great while, men. Each week the violation is more elaborate, more lurid, more unspeakable. When the show first aired, Rosie O'Donnell, I believe, objected quite vocally when one of the stars appeared on her show. O'Donnell said she didn't understand why such a show was needed. People dismissed her objections and the incident was quickly forgotten. The series is in its 15th season and shows no signs of ending anytime soon. When O'Donnell objected to SVU's premise, when she dared to suggest that perhaps a show dealing so explicitly with sexual assault was unnecessary and too much, people treated her like she was the crazy one, the prude censor. I watch SVU religiously and have seen every episode more than once. I am not sure what that says about me. It is rather ironic that only a couple of weeks before publishing Vicious Assault Shakes Texas Town, The Times ran an editorial about the war on women. This topic matters to me. I once wrote an essay about how, as a writer who is also a woman, I increasingly feel that writing is a political act, whether I intend it to be or not, because we live in a culture where McKinley's article is permissible and publishable. I am troubled by how we have allowed such intellectual distance between violence and the representation of violence. We talk about rape, but we don't carefully talk about rape. We live in a strange and terrible time for women. There are days when I think it has always been a strange and terrible time to be a woman. Womanhood feels more strange and terrible now because progress has not served women as well as it has served men. We are still stymied by the issues our forebears railed against. It is nothing less than horrifying to realize we live in a culture where the paper of record can write an article that comes off as sympathetic to 18 rapists while encouraging victim blaming. Have we forgotten who an 11-year-old is? Perhaps people do not understand the trauma of gang rape. While there's no benefit to creating a hierarchy of rape, where one kind of rape is worse than another, because rape is, at the end of the day, rape, there is something particularly insidious about gang rape, about the idea that a pack of men feed on one another's frenzy and both individually and collectively believe it is their right to violate a woman's body in such an unspeakable manner and watch the others take turns. Gang rape is a difficult experience to survive physically and emotionally. There is the exposure to unwanted pregnancy and sexually transmitted diseases, vaginal and anal tearing, fistula and vaginal scar tissue. The reproductive system is often irreparably damaged. Victims of gang rape in particular have a higher chance of miscarrying a pregnancy. Psychologically, there are any number of effects, including PTSD, anxiety, fear, coping with the social stigma, and coping with shame, and on and on. The aftermath can be far-reaching and more devastating than the rape itself. We rarely discuss these things, though. Instead, we are careless. We delude ourselves that rape can be washed away, as neatly as it is on TV and in the movies, where the trajectory of victimhood is neatly defined. I cannot speak universally, but given what I know about gang rape, the experience is wholly consuming. There is little point in pretending otherwise. Perhaps McKinley is, like so many people today, anesthetized or somehow willfully distanced from such brutal realities. Despite this inundation of rape imagery, where we are immersed in a rape culture, one that is overly permissive toward all manner of sexual violence, Not enough victims of gang rape speak out about the toll the experience exacts. The right stories are not being told, or we're not writing enough about the topic of rape in the right ways. Perhaps we too casually use the term rape culture to address the very specific problems that rise from a culture mired in sexual violence. Should we instead focus on rapist culture, because decades of addressing rape culture has accomplished so little? In her essay, Your Friends and Rapists, Sarah Nicole Prickett writes, "Yes, I am tired of rape stories. I think rape stories are boring. I am sick of rape stories on CNN and sicker of rape stories on Jezebel. I would like instead to see national televised debates and full episodes of morning radio shows and several long-form podcasts and a portion of the next State of the Union address dedicated to determining whether men should be allowed to keep their dicks." The weariness and rage of this statement is palpable, but it is also important. Prickett is suggesting that we reframe the conversation about rape. It is a call to address dick culture, which Prickett refers to as the inordinate pride men feel in owning and wielding their dicks. I am approaching this topic somewhat selfishly. I am concerned about rape culture and how we perpetuate it, intentionally or not. But I also write about sexual violence in my fiction. The why of this writerly obsession doesn't matter, but I return to the same stories. Writing is cheaper than therapy or drugs. When I read articles such as McKinley's, I consider my responsibility as a writer and what writers can do to critique rape culture intelligently and illuminate the realities of sexual violence without exploiting the subject. In Margaret Atwood's short story, Rape Fantasies, a woman, Estelle, shares her rape fantasies, ones where she gets away from a would-be rapist instead of being ravished. Atwood exposes the glossy treatment of rape in women's magazines, the casual, flitty way in which rape fantasies might be talked about over lunch with friends. The story explicitly addresses the sense of the inevitable fostered by rape culture. A question of when a woman will be raped, rather than if, and uses dark humor brilliantly. Atwood offers an intriguing way of upholding a writer's responsibility without compromising her artistic integrity. Rape Fantasies was first published in 1977, but the story's commentary would be just as timely were it published today. Rape culture, it seems, doesn't really change. This responsibility of the writer was always on my mind as I wrote my debut novel, An Untamed State. It's the story of a brutal kidnapping in Haiti, and part of the story involves gang rape. Writing that kind of story requires going to a dark place. At times, I nauseated myself in the writing and by what I am capable of writing and imagining, my ability to go there. As I write any of these stories, I wonder if I am being gratuitous. I want to get it right. But how do you get this sort of thing right? How do you write violence authentically without making it exploitative? I worry I am contributing to the cultural numbness that would allow an article like the one in the Times to be written and published, that allows rape to be such rich fodder for popular culture and entertainment. We cannot separate violence in fiction from violence in the world, no matter how hard we try. As Laura Tanner notes in her book, Intimate Violence, the act of reading a representation of violence is defined by the reader's suspension between the semiotic and the real, between a representation and the material dynamics of violence which it evokes, reflects, or transforms. She also goes on to say that the distance and detachment of a reader who must leave his or her body behind in order to enter imaginatively into the scene of violence make it possible for representations of violence to obscure the material dynamics of bodily violation, erasing not only the victim's body, but his or her pain. The way we currently represent rape in books, in newspapers, on television, on the silver screen, often allows us to ignore the material realities of rape, the impact of rape, the meaning of rape. While I have these concerns, I also feel committed to telling the truth. These violences happen even if bearing such witness contributes to a spectacle of sexual violence. When we're talking about race or religion or politics, it is often said we need to speak carefully. These are difficult topics where we need to be vigilant not only in what we say, but also in how we express ourselves. That same care must extend to how we write about violence, and sexual violence in particular. In the Times article, the phrase sexual assault is used, as is the phrase the girl had been forced to have sex with several men. The word rape is used only twice, and not really in connection with the victim. That is not a careful use of language. Language in this instance, and far more often than makes sense, is used to buffer our sensibilities from the brutality of rape, from the extraordinary nature of such a crime. Feminist scholars have long called for a rereading of rape. Higgins and Silver note that the act of rereading rape involves more than listening to silences. It requires restoring rape to the literal, to the body, restoring, that is, the violence, the physical sexual violation. We need to find new ways, whether in fiction or creative nonfiction or journalism, for rewriting rape. Ways of rewriting that restore the actual violence to these crimes and make it impossible for men to be excused for committing atrocities, and make it impossible for articles like McKinley's to be written, to be published, to be considered acceptable. An 11-year-old girl was raped by 18 men. The suspects ranged in age from middle schoolers to a 27-year-old. There are pictures and videos. Her life will never be the same. The New York Times, however, would like you to worry about those boys who will have to live with this for the rest of their lives and the poor, poor town. That is not simply the careless language of sexual violence. It is the criminal language of sexual violence. What we hunger for. All too often, representations of a woman's strength overlook the cost of that strength, where it rises from, and how it is called upon when needed most. The Hunger Games, released in 2008, is the first book in a trilogy by Suzanne Collins. Catching Fire and Mockingjay, the next two books, were released in 2009 and 2010. The franchise was an instant success. More than 2.9 million copies of the books are in print. There are more than 20 foreign editions. The Hunger Games was on the New York Times bestseller list for 100 weeks. There are special editions. There is merchandise, including a Katniss Barbie, which Katniss would absolutely hate. In March 2012, the movie was released and earned nearly $460 million worldwide. The series tells the story about a young woman, Katniss Everdeen, who doesn't know her own strength until she is confronted by her need for that strength. She is a tough young woman who is forced to become even stronger in circumstances that might otherwise break her. She is a young woman who has no choice but to fight for survival. For herself, her family, her people. I have found myself inexplicably drawn to these books. The complex world Collins has created and the people she has placed in that world. I am not the kind of person who becomes so invested in a book or movie or television show that my interest becomes a hobby or intense obsession, one where I start to declare allegiances or otherwise demonstrate a serious level of commitment to something fictional I had no hand in creating. Or I didn't used to be that kind of person. Let me be clear. Team PETA. I cannot fathom how one could be on any other team. Gail? I can barely acknowledge him. PETA, on the other hand, is everything. He frosts things and bakes bread and is unconditional and unwavering in his love. And also, he is very, very strong. He can throw a sack of flour, is what I am saying. PETA is a place of solace and hope, and he is a good kisser. In December 2011, I didn't know that much about the Hunger Games. Given my abiding interest in pop culture, I'm not sure how I missed the books. Then a friend suggested that The Hunger Games would be a great book to teach in my novel writing class. So I decided to check it out. I do most of my leisure reading at the gym. I hate exercise. Yes, it's good for you, and weight loss and whatever. But normally, I work out and want to die. I knew I was in love with The Hunger Games when I did not want to get off the treadmill. The book captivated me. I wanted to stay in the world Collins created. More than that, The Hunger Games moved me. There was so much at stake, so much drama, and it was all so intriguing, so hypnotizing, so intense and dark. I particularly appreciated what the book got right about strength and endurance, suffering and survival. I found myself gasping and hissing and even bursting into tears more than once. I looked insane, but I did not care. I was completely without shame. After finishing The Hunger Games, I quickly read the next two books in the trilogy. My obsession at this point was raging and white hot. I was so invested I couldn't stop talking about the books. I daydreamed about Katniss, PETA, and, I suppose, sometimes Gale, as well as the other compelling characters, Cinna, Rue, Thresh, Haymitch, Finnick, Annie. I wanted the best for these characters, even when all seemed hopeless, was hopeless. This obsession intensified well before I realized the first movie would be released. That development took things to a whole new level. I started counting down to the movie well before opening day. I could hardly contain myself. I attended the midnight showing even though I had to teach the next same morning. I warned my gentleman friend that he couldn't mock me for how I reacted during the movie because I knew I was going to get close to the rapture and didn't want to be judged. I live in a small town, so I expected that there wouldn't be many people attending the midnight opening. But AMC screened The Hunger Games on all 10 screens, and every screening was sold out. My friends and I joked that we were probably some of the oldest people in the auditorium. It was no small relief when we saw some silver-haired folk among us. As we waited, the teenagers and tweens chattered energetically about the books and the casting and whatever else young people talk about these days. Nearly all of them were staring at electronic devices. I thought, don't they have school tomorrow? The movie began, and I held my breath. I had so many expectations, and I didn't want those expectations, those hopes, destroyed by Hollywood, a known killer of dreams. I was not disappointed. I had feelings throughout the movie. True, mad, deep feelings. Had I been alone, I would have embarrassed myself with vulgar displays of enthusiasm. At times, I wanted to spontaneously break into applause to celebrate the thrill of seeing the book I've read so many times playing out 20 feet high. There was just so much to look at, the set design, the costumes, the glittery cast. The movie was almost cerebral and meticulously faithful to the book when it needed to be. The production values were impeccable with only a few missteps. Whatever the hell was going on with Katniss's flaming outfits, for example. The actors acquitted themselves well. I became even more fervently a member of Team PETA. I left the movie thrilled with the overall experience of the movie. As a critic, I recognize the significant flaws, I do, but The Hunger Games is not a movie I am able to watch as a critic. The story means too much to me. The Hunger Games books are not perfect. While the writing is engaging and well-paced, the quality of the prose weakens with each successive book. Many of the secondary characters aren't well-developed, and at times the plot strains credulity. The third book is rather rushed, and some of Colin's choices feel almost gratuitous, particularly with regard to the characters she chose to kill off. The complete erasure of sexuality is problematic. Intimacy is conveyed through a great deal of kissing, to the point that it becomes laughable. It is disturbing that within the world of The Hunger Games, it is perfectly acceptable for teenagers to kill one another and die or otherwise suffer in really violent ways. But it is not at all acceptable for them to explore their sexuality. I was struck consistently by the sheer brutality and yet the undeniable heart of the story, of the characters, of my dearest PETA and his devotion for Katniss, and how, toward the end, even when it seemed hopeless, they found their way to each other. The book's imperfections are easily forgiven because the best parts of the books are the truest, that sometimes the one you love best is the one who has always been right by your side, even when you didn't notice. I am fascinated by strength in women. People tend to think I'm strong. I'm not. And yet, I identify with Katniss because throughout the trilogy, the people around Katniss expect her to be strong, and she does her best to meet those expectations, even when it costs her a great deal. I come from a loving, tight-knit, imperfect, but great family. My parents have always been involved in my life, even when I push them away. I have wanted for little. One of my biggest weaknesses, one that has always shamed me, is that I have always been lonely. I've struggled to make friends because I can be socially awkward, because I'm weird, because I live in my head. When I was young, we moved around a lot. So there was rarely any time to get to know a new place, let alone new people. Loneliness was the one familiar thing, making me this bottomless pit of need, open and gaping and desperate for anything to fill me up. I should not be this way, but I am. When I was in middle school, when I was young, old enough to like a boy but young enough to have no clue what that meant, there was a boy who I thought was my boyfriend, and who said he was my boyfriend, but who also completely ignored me at school. It's a sad, silly story lots of girls know. It was fine because when we were together, he made me feel like he could fill my gaping void. He was terrible, but he was also charming and persuasive. I was nerdy and friendless, all lanky limbs and crazy hair, and he was beautiful and popular. I accepted the state of affairs between us. When we were together, he'd tell me what he wanted to do to me. He wasn't asking permission. I was not an unwilling participant. I was not a willing participant. I felt nothing one way or the other. I wanted him to love me. I wanted to make him happy. If doing things to my body made him happy, I would let him do anything to my body. My body was nothing to me. It was just meat and bones around that void he filled by touching me. Technically, we didn't have sex, but we did everything else. The more I gave, the more he took. At school, he continued looking right through me. I was dying, but I was happy. I was happy because he was happy. Because if I gave enough, he might love me. As an adult, I don't understand how I allowed him to treat me like that. I don't understand how he could be so terrible. I don't understand how desperately I sacrificed myself. I was young. I was always a good girl. I was a straight-A student, top of my class. I did as I was told. I was polite to my elders. I was good to my siblings. I went to church. It was very easy to hide how very bad I was becoming from my family, from everyone. Being good is the best way to be bad. It never crossed my mind to say no, or that I should say no, that I could say no. He started pressuring me to have sex. I didn't say no, but I didn't say yes, and I did not want to say yes. I wanted to say no, but could not because I would lose him. I would be nothing again. One day, we were riding our bikes in the woods. About a mile deep, there was an abandoned hunting cabin often used by teenagers to do the things teenagers do when they're hiding out in the woods. It was disgusting. Small, a dirt floor littered with empty beer cans and used condom wrappers and discarded cigarette packs. There was a small bench. The glass in the windows was broken, brown with age. Several of his friends from school were there. I didn't know them well, had mostly seen them in the halls. They were all popular, handsome. They would never have reason to know a girl like me. Quiet, shy, awkward. I did not understand, not at first. I was very naive despite what I thought I knew. Once I realized what was going on, I assumed this boy wanted me to give his friends blowjobs. I did not want to do that, to share what I thought was private between this boy and me. But I would have. I could have. If only to make him happy. I told him I wanted us to leave, to continue on our bike ride. I did that. I did try to save myself. I did understand I was not safe. They were all so much bigger, and I finally felt something. I felt fear, but I didn't know how to say no. I tried to leave, to run out of that cabin, but they grabbed me just past the threshold. I screamed. I opened my mouth and I screamed, and my voice echoed through the woods, and no one came for me. Not one person heard me. We were far too deep. The boy I thought was my boyfriend pushed me to the ground. He took my clothes off, and I lay there, with no body to speak of, just a flat board of skin and girl bones. I tried to cover myself with my arms, but I couldn't, not really. The boys stared at me while they drank beer, and laughed, and said things I didn't understand, because I knew things but I knew nothing about what a group of boys could do to kill a girl. I was a good girl, who went to church. I had faith, I believed in God back then, so I prayed. I prayed for God to save me because I could not save me. I whispered, "Our Father," because it was the only prayer I knew by heart. I begged God to change those boys' minds. He didn't. And then I did say no. I found my voice and it didn't matter. And I wasted my first love, my first everything, on a boy who thought so very little of me. They kept me there for hours. It was as bad as you might expect. The repercussions linger. I walked home alone, pushing my stupid bike, hating myself for thinking this boy loved me. I was a good girl, So that's what my parents saw when I came home a completely different person and went to my room and tried to pull myself together well enough to be the girl everyone knew. I had to hide what happened because I didn't want to get in trouble, because my parents were strict, because you're not allowed to have sex before marriage, because I was a good girl, so that's what I did. I swallowed the truth, which only made that gaping void of need inside me yawn wider. Just because you survive something does not mean you are strong. The worst of it was going to school the next day. I didn't want to, but I had no choice. I was a good girl. I went to French class and sat in the second to last row. It was uncomfortable in every way. Just as class was about to begin, the boy behind me grabbed my shoulder, and I felt a surge of adrenaline, then terror. He stood and leaned into me. He said, "You're a slut." And everyone heard, and they snickered. Everyone started calling me a slut. When the teacher came in and stood at the front of the room, she looked at me differently. If she could have, she would have called me a slut, too. I was mortified and trapped. I sat perfectly still and tried to concentrate, but all I could hear was the hiss of the word slut. That shame was one of the worst things I have ever known. Slut was my name for the rest of the school year because those boys went and told a very different story about what happened in the woods. In June 2011, Megan Cox Gurdon wrote in the Wall Street Journal about how young adult fiction has taken too dark a turn, has unnecessarily exposed young readers to complex, difficult situations before they are mature enough to make sense of those situations. She wrote, "If books show us the world, teen fiction can be like a hall of funhouse mirrors, constantly reflecting back hideously distorted portrayals of what life is. There are, of course, exceptions, but a careless young reader or one who seeks out depravity will find himself surrounded by images not of joy or beauty, but of damage, brutality, and losses of the most horrendous kinds." She is correct in noting that there is darkness in some young adult fiction, but she largely ignores the diversity of the genre and the countless titles that aren't grounded in damage, brutality, or loss. More troubling, though, is the suggestion that somehow reality should be sanitized for teen readers. The critical response to Gurdon's article was swift and passionate from writers and readers alike. Sherman Alexie wrote, "There are millions of teens who read because they are sad and lonely and enraged. They read because they live in an often terrible world. They read because they believe, despite the callow protestations of certain adults, that books, especially the dark and dangerous ones, will save them." I learned a long time ago that life introduces young people to situations they are in no way prepared for. Even good girls, lucky girls who want for nothing. Sometimes when you least expect it, you become the girl in the woods. You lose your name because another one is forced on you. You think you are alone until you find books about girls like you. Salvation is certainly among the reasons I read. Reading and writing have always pulled me out of the darkest experiences in my life. Stories have given me a place in which to lose myself. They have allowed me to remember. They have allowed me to forget. They have allowed me to imagine different endings and better possible worlds. Perhaps I loved the Hunger Games trilogy because the books were, in their own way, a fairy tale, and I am always, always in search of a fairy tale. As I read the Hunger Games series, I thought of Gurdon's article because I was struck more than once by the intensity of the traumas the characters were put through, the relentlessness of that trauma and the visible effects. At times I thought, this is too much, but I know something of the world now, and there are rarely limits to suffering. In this trilogy, suffering has few limits, and suffering has consequences that, all too often, we forget when narratives neatly imply that everything turns out okay. When narratives imply that it gets better without demonstrating what it takes to get better. In The Hunger Games, it takes everything. My love for these books, at its purest, is not really about PETA or anything silly and girly. I love that a young woman character is fierce and strong, but human in ways I find believable, relatable. Katniss is clearly a heroine, but a heroine with issues. She intrigues me because she never seems to know her own strength. She isn't blandly insecure the way girls are often forced to be in fiction. She is brave, but flawed. She is a heroine, but she is also a girl who loves two boys and can't choose which boy she loves more. She is not sure she is up to the task of leading a revolution, but she does her best, even as she doubts herself. Katniss endures the unendurable. She is damaged, and it shows. At times, it might seem like her suffering is gratuitous, but life often presents unendurable circumstances people manage to survive. Only the details differ. The Hunger Games trilogy is dark and brutal, but in the end, the books also offer hope for a better world and a better people, and for one woman, a better life. A life she can share with a man who understands her strength and doesn't expect her to compromise that strength. A man who can hold her weak places and love her through the darkest of her memories, the worst of her damage. Of course, I love The Hunger Games. The trilogy offers the tempered hope that everyone who survives something unendurable hungers for. The Illusion of Safety. The Safety of Illusion. When I see men who look like him or his friends, when I smell beer on a man's breath, when I smell polo cologne, when I hear a harsh laugh, when I walk by a group of men clustered together and there's no one around, when I see a woman being attacked in a movie or on television, when I am in the woods or driving through a heavily wooded area, when I read about experiences that are all too familiar, when I go through security at the airport and I am pulled aside for extra screening, which seems to happen every single time I travel, when I'm having sex and my wrists are unexpectedly pinned over my head, when I see a young girl of a certain age, when it happens, a sharp pang runs right through the center of my body. Or I feel sick to my stomach. Or I vomit. Or I break into a cold sweat. Or I feel myself shutting down and I go into a quiet place. Or I close my fingers into tight fists until my knuckles ache. My reaction is visceral, and I have to take a deep breath or two or three or more. I have to remind myself of the time and distance between then and now. I have to remind myself that I am not the girl in the woods anymore. I have to convince myself I never will be again. It has gotten better over the years. It gets better. Until it doesn't. The first congressional hearing on television violence was held in 1954, and in the ensuing years, the debate about television and violence has been ongoing. The Telecommunications Act of 1996 dictated that televisions needed to include a chip to monitor program ratings. The current television parental guidelines went into effect on January 1, 1997. These guidelines were designed to help parents monitor what their children were watching and get some sense of the appropriateness of a given television program. The guidelines rated television content by age appropriateness from G, all audiences, to MA, mature audiences only. There are also a second set of guidelines designed to protect children from violence, coarse language, and sexual themes. These guidelines, of course, only work if someone is monitoring what children are watching and is able to enforce a set of standards about what children can watch. Cable boxes and most televisions now allow parents to lock certain channels or shows with ratings they consider inappropriate for their children, but there is only so much a parent can control. How effective, then, are these ratings and guidelines? In Ratings and Advisories, Implications for the New Ratings System for Television, Joanne Cantor et al. Note how research shows that parental discretion warnings and the more restrictive MPAA ratings stimulate some children's interest in viewing programs. And the increased interest in restricted programs is more strongly linked to the children's desire to reject control over their viewing than to their seeking out violent content. Even children want a taste of forbidden fruit. Or, at the very least, children don't want to be told they cannot taste that fruit. Television ratings are like airport security, an act of theater, an illusion designed to reassure us, to make us feel like we control the influences we allow into our lives. We want our children to be safe. We want to be safe. We want and need to pretend this is possible. When I see the phrase trigger warning, I am far more inclined to read whatever follows. I myself enjoy the taste of forbidden fruit. I also know trigger warnings cannot save me from myself. Trigger warnings are essentially ratings or protective guidelines for the largely unmoderated internet. Trigger warnings provide order to the chaos of the interwebs. They are a signal that the content following the warning may be upsetting, may trigger bad memories or reminders of traumatic or sensitive experiences. Trigger warnings allow readers a choice: steel yourself and continue reading, or protect yourself and look away. Many feminist communities use trigger warnings, particularly in online forums when discussing rape, sexual abuse, and violence. By using these warnings, these communities are saying, "This is a safe space. We will protect you from unexpected reminders of your history." Members of these communities are given the illusion they can be protected. There are a great many potential trigger warnings. Over the years, I have seen trigger warnings for eating disorders, poverty, self-injury, bullying, heteronormativity, suicide, sizism, genocide, slavery, mental illness, explicit fiction, explicit discussions of sexuality, homosexuality, homophobia, addiction, alcoholism, racism, the Holocaust, ableism, and Dan Savage. Life, apparently, requires a trigger warning. This is the uncomfortable truth. Everything is a trigger for someone. There are things you cannot tell just by looking at someone. We all have history. You can think you're over your history. You can think the past is the past, and then something happens, often innocuous, that shows you how far you are from over it. The past is always with you. Some people want to be protected from this truth. I used to think I didn't have triggers because I told myself I was tough, I was steel. I was broken beneath the surface, but my skin was forged, impenetrable. Then I realized I had all kinds of triggers. I simply had buried them deep until there was no more room inside me. When the dam burst, I had to learn how to stare those triggers down. I had a lot of help, Years and years of help. I have writing. Every so often, debates about trigger warnings flare hotly and both sides are resolute. Trigger warnings are either ineffective and impractical or vital for creating safe online spaces. It has been suggested more than once that if you don't believe in trigger warnings, you aren't respecting